We're on page 121, and we're beginning paragraph 100 in the Kuzari. We recently finished a discussion of the precision of the mitzvahs, as to why Hashem is so demanding of very, very specific ritual behavior of the Jewish people in the Torah. And we explained, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi explained this, because the physical world is structured just so that you got to get it right in order for there to be some kind of benefit in the behavior that you do, just like any chemical reaction requires exact measurements and exact specifications. And even if you're just a slight amount of dosage off, a little bit too much, a little bit too little, then the chemical reaction is not going to work. The medicine's not going to work with the body, and so too the mitzvah's not going to work either. Now, this was really a response of the aftermath of the golden calf. That really, one of the reasons why Rabbi Yehuda maybe brings this up over here again is because he wants to make sure that we understand that the error of the Jewish people was not in their intention, but it was in their execution of their service to Hashem. The way that you worship God, despite your best intentions, has to be with great precision, according to Hashem's prescribed specifications. If you try to circumvent that system, if you try to do something that's not sanctioned by Hashem, but no matter how good it feels, no matter how meaningful it is to you, then it's not going to have its desired effect. And that's why he launched into this discussion. And now we get into another discussion, which is really the Kuzari king speaking. It's now the Kuzari king's sort of extrapolating or inferring an important point from what the rabbi has just told him. And that is that now that we've discovered, or now that we've affirmed that the mitzvahs truly have this certain supernatural quality to them, and they sort of defy our intellect, we need to reinforce our belief in the divine origin of the Torah. Catering service is now available. Please help yourselves if you'd like to get a drink. Once you put forth that the mitzvahs defy human understanding, then you have to reinforce the fact that indeed that they come from Hashem. And this idea is going, thank you very much, Ted. This idea is going to converge on something else very important that the rabbi had also set down, which is a continuation of the golden calf as well. Why did we embark on a discussion of the golden calf in the first place? Well, we gave a number of reasons. One of them has to do with the precision of mitzvahs and the need for conforming to the exact prescription of God, and not doing any kind of your own extemporaneous worship. But another reason, if you remember, the whole question that the Khazar king had posed to the rabbi was, how can you claim that the Jewish people have this very special chosen status in light of their almost immediate fall from grace, right after they received the Torah, they worshipped a golden calf? This was the challenge that was put forth, and why the rabbi felt he needed to respond to the question about the Egel Hazav, about the golden calf. And at that time we explained that this is Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's whole way of composing prose. When you look at something written by the Rambam, for example, everything is extremely well organized, right? First we're going to discuss what it means to be God. And then we're going to talk about God's creation of the universe. Then we're going to talk, you go topic by topic by topic. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, as a poet, really has a more pastoral, sweeping view of in his thinking. And so sometimes he will combine a number of different themes and connect them in more of an analog fashion, which is really like sort of holistically just connect various ideas together. Not necessarily in this very digitized, organized way, which is more in line with the very systematized methodology of the Rambam. And there's tremendous value to the way that the Rambam systematizes knowledge. Chapter, topic, right? But Rabbi Yehuda Levi doesn't go that way. As you've noticed, it's very hard to write a table of contents for the Kuzari, because there are so many different ideas that get mixed in. We weave in and out of different topics back and forth constantly. Just in the first essay, you see that. And so here there's a convergence once again of the ideas that he's been weaving in back and forth. Number one is the chosenness of the Jewish people. And this is going to become we're going to returning back to that topic, because we're going to talk about why Hashem, when he chose to give the Torah, he gave it only to one nation and not to the entire world. That's one of the topics that we're going to cover starting with paragraph 100. And it's also going to address as to the plausibility of the divine origin of the Torah. How it's plausible that the Torah is from God and not man-made. And these two ideas, the plausibility of the divinity of the Torah, and why Hashem chose to only give it to Klal Yisrael and not to the entire world, are really two ideas that directly relate to the discussion of the Egel HaZahav, of the golden calf. Is that on the one hand, we need to address why the Jews and no one else, especially in light of the Egel HaZahav. And so that Rabbi Yehuda Levi has addressed, and now he's going to address even more. Okay, now that you've explained why the Jews have redeemable qualities even after the golden calf, well, then why not give it to the whole world? And then also related to this idea about the precision, because of the sort of supernatural nature of God's prescribed commandments, we have to now reinforce the fact that this did indeed come from a divine source. If it was man-made, the Torah, then there would be no reason for us to have to conform to a specific, very, very constricting and confining set of commandments, if this was man-made. So we have to really reinforce the idea that this is not man-made, this is from Hashem. And now that we establish that it's man-made and it's not man-made and it's from Hashem, we're going to also explain why it was necessary only to give it to one nation and not to an entire world. Okay, those are the two ideas. I hope I've made that clear. Two ideas converging into one in this section. So if we can get someone to read, please. Any volunteers for readers? It's a small group today. Yes, go ahead. Thank you. Sure.
The Kuzari said, one could comfortably accept the Torah without any doubt or hesitancy once the following were fulfilled. First, a prophet would come to sorely oppressed slaves and would attest to them that they were going to be liberated from bondage without any delay on a specific date and in a specific fashion. He would also guarantee their entrance into Canaan, which at that time was in the hands of seven nations, each one mightier than them. He would also delineate each tribe's allotted portion in the land before they actually entered.
Okay, so let's create an analogy today. Someone comes to the people of Mexico and says, in 6 months, Mexico will be taking over the United States. And not only that, but we, the Mexican people, who have formerly been working as waiters and as busboys in the restaurants of the Americans, we will be taking over their land and we will be taking over their businesses, and they instead will be working for us. And those who choose not to work for us will be ejected, will be deported from the United States. Okay, so the prophet comes to you and tells you that. Now, that's fairly unlikely. And especially, I mean, this is just an analogy. This was a slave class. This is not just a third world country. I hope I'm not offending any Mexicans in the audience. I think Mexico is fair to call still a third world country, although it's getting up there. But, or in any event, or let's say Guatemala, which is a real third world country. Okay, Guatemalans of the world. Okay, we're going to be taking over the United States. And that's going to happen in 6 months, and they're going to start working for us. The Americans will work for us, and we've been instead working for them. So, and the mighty American army will be defeated in the hands of the Guatemalans. That sounds to be fairly unlikely. And a person would only be able to make such a claim if he was coming with divine authority, because otherwise not only would people have a hard time believing him, but also he would never be able to make good on such a claim, especially if he tells them exactly when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. So let us continue, please.
If this prophet could fulfill all this in a short period of time with amazing wonders, this would verify the greatness of the dispatcher of this prophet and the honor of the messenger prophet. It would also confirm the greatness of this nation, since it was this nation exclusively to whom he was sent.
All right. Now this, by the way, was one of Moshe's arguments as to why Hashem should not punish the Jewish people excessively after the sin of the Meraglim, after the sin of the spies. Because it's a diminution of God's stature if it's going to take us an additional 40 years to go into Eretz Yisrael and conquer Canaan. This in some way indicates that there's some limitation to Hashem's ability. So forget about the Jewish people for a second, Hashem. What about you? B'yomeru Mitzrayim. What are the Egyptians going to say? What's the world going to say? And that's the appeal that Moshe Rabbeinu used in Parsha Shlach, to try and appeal to Hashem to not excessively punish, or really do anything to punish the Jewish people. Let them go to Eretz Yisrael right away. Hashem said, no. V'yimalei chavod haaretz, v'yimalei chavodi es kol haaretz, that my honor has to fill the entire world. And it's more important for the Jewish people to understand that they can't take liberties with Hashem than it is for the rest of the world to understand. But nevertheless, this is the idea. The idea is that Moshe Rabbeinu, everything that he tells the Jewish people comes true, and it's through Nisim, it's through miracles, and this would confirm the greatness of the nation, since it was this nation exclusively to whom this prophet was sent. So again, we're going on to the chosen nation theme as well. We're proving the veracity and the plausibility of the divine origin of the Torah, and we're also at the same time covering this idea of the chosenness of the Jewish people. Yes?
Okay. I mean, all of these things go back beyond Moshe, like we have a promise ready for the time of the others that they would be liberated and they would get the land of Israel. So I mean, it shouldn't have been a tremendous shock to them to hear this, that they were expecting it to happen at some point.
Yes, they were expecting it, and that's why when Moshe came to them, that's why Hashem said, V'shama'u l'kolecha. They will listen to you because they are expecting it. And you're coming at the allotted time. There were other times when segments of Jews thought that it was time to leave. We know the story about the B'nai Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, who left 30 years prematurely, and they failed. They perished in the desert. And so Moshe was telling them it's going to happen dafka at this date, and I'm being sent by Hashem. So that's why he was believable to them. But it also proves that he was coming from Hashem. That's what he's trying to convey over here. Yes, continue, please.
On the other hand, if this prophet would claim that he had been sent to perfect the whole world, his mission would not even be halfway successful. This would then taint his credibility because God's professed intent would not be fulfilled. Another indication that the Torah was not meant for the rest of the world is that the prophet's mission would be obstructed by the fact that his Torah is in Hebrew. If God's intent was to give it to the nations which knew no Hebrew, the prophet would have to lift a heavy burden and greatly exert himself to bring the nations of Sheba, India and Khazaria, to understand and fulfill what is written in it.
Okay, let's hold it here for just a second. There's a lot that he's pointing out over here. This is clearly a polemic. I'm not sure if everyone sees it, but do you see the polemic that he is lodging here, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? When I use the term polemic, I mean, this is a religious polemic against the two major faiths. Who is he trying to prove is wrong over here? Yes, Christianity and Islam. Okay, this is a polemic against both Christianity and Islam in these very short sentences. What Rabbi Yehuda Levy's basically said is that Jesus' message was that he's here to perfect the entire world. And that ostensibly was Muhammad's ideology as well, that the whole world has to convert to Islam and that through Islam the world will be perfected. That has never been Judaism's claim, which is one of this This is one of the most salient points if you want to try and point out to someone how Judaism is not racist and is not condescending to other religions. Well, consider that in Christianity, if you're not a Christian, then in most Christian doctrinaires would tell you that if you're not a Christian, you can't in some way be saved or in some other, there's a lack of redemption, okay? Lack of salvation, that's what they call it, okay? Whether or not you're condemned to eternal damnation, right? There's different ideologies, yeah? In Islam, that's also clear, that if you're an infidel, if you don't accept Muhammad, I mean, they go so far as to say that certain Muslims are infidels because they believe certain things that they believe. If you're a Shia, then you're a Sunni, is an apikoris, and if you're a Shia, then a Sunni is an apikoris, right? So, and certainly if you haven't accepted Muhammad as the final prophet, then you're certainly an infidel and you'll be condemned to eternal damnation. And the problem with that is, says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, there are two problems. Number one, if your claim is that you've come to perfect the whole world, then there's a problem with the veracity of that claim of sort of trying to prove it. How can you prove it? It's impossible to prove that you've been sent by God because you'll never be able to in one lifetime fulfill that directive. No one in human history has succeeded in perfecting the entire world during their lifetime. No one's been able to do that. There have been people that have had a very, very positive influence on their sphere of influence. And probably we could suggest that the largest sphere of influence that happened during a person's lifetime was Moshe Rabbeinu. And that because he was standing atop Har Sinai when there were over a million people present, these people heard Hashem speak and they received the Torah, they accepted the Torah, and they became completely transformed individuals as a result. What other kind of religion has ever been able to do that kind of transformative experience to so many people? But even then, the claim of Judaism was not that we're here to change the world. The claim of Judaism is that we're here to forge one nation among other nations that have to live by the Torah. The rest of the world does not have to live by the Torah. The rest of the world does not have to become Jewish. The rest of the world is not condemned to eternal damnation. The rest of the world has a share in the world to come. The rest of the world can be perfectly holy and happy and righteous without being Jews. It's always been Judaism's claim. It's unique. It's unique among the other Western faiths. And the problem with Christianity and Islam, for that very reason, is the veracity of the claim that I've come to perfect the whole world. It hasn't happened yet. As a matter of fact, this was one of the arguments that the Ramban made against Pablo Cristiani in their public disputation in the 13th century. It was one of the reasons why the Ramban was exiled from his home, from northern Spain, is because he demonstrated that Jesus never did what he said he was going to do. And it hasn't happened yet. There have been more wars, the Ramban says, in the name of Christ than there have been, than if there were no, had there been no Christianity to begin with. So that's the problem, is that you can never, there's a lack of verification, there's a lack of veracity to the claim, because even hundreds of years and thousands of years after the words of their Messiah, his words have not come true. Question.
Yes, so, but they all have to recognize that there's only one God, and their messiahs are not correct, so they will have to change, according to in the time of Shia, right?
Yes, now, the recognition of one God is one of the Noahide commandments. So that's not accepting the Torah upon yourself, that's accepting Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. So the world, God calls upon all nations of the world to acknowledge the one God. A person who doesn't is called an idolater, and he's in violation of even one of the laws that God calls upon all B'nai Noach, all the sons of Noah, to adhere to. And the prophet says several times, the Nevi'im say that Bayom Hahu, on the day when Mashiach comes, Yeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, his name will be one, he will be one, and his name will be one, because the world will come to that recognition. The Rambam says that the reason why Hashem allowed for the rise of Christianity and Islam is as a transition point to enable the world to come to that recognition slowly. If there had never been a Christianity, if there had never been an Islam, and the world was merely pagan, then when Mashiach comes, it would be too difficult for the other nations of the world to make that transition from paganism to monotheism. So the transition, sort of the introduction of a monotheistic ideology, is for these other Western faiths. But even after that adjustment is made, they're not going to have to live by the Torah. They'll live by the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. Yes?
Sometimes it scares me when I see how devoted other people are to their religions, because they're just as devoted to their religions as we are to ours.
Yes.
And we think we have the truth, but they also think they have the truth.
Correct.
It's scary.
It's scary in what sense? Because you're not sure whether you're right and they're wrong, or whether they're right and you're wrong. I'm not putting you on the spot. That's a legitimate issue. What if they're right and we're wrong? Well, that's why we're studying the Kuzari. You see, one of the major exercises of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is to demonstrate the proofs and evidence for the greater veracity of the Jewish faith over the other faiths. There's a greater sense of plausibility to the Jewish faith than there is to the Mohammedan or the Christian faith. That's Rabbi Yehuda Levi's contention. It's a more plausible argument.
But do you ever think to yourself, yeah, we think it's more plausible, but they think this is more plausible?
So, you know what? I totally agree with you. Totally agree. So go study. Go and study. In other words, go line up. If once you feel duly fortified in your emunah, I'm not telling you to become a Muslim. What I'm suggesting is, you're an adult. And realize, I'm not suggesting that your fifth grader do this, right? I'm suggesting you as a mother, as an adult, as a responsible Jew, if this doubt exists, then study some books on Islam. There are a lot of beautiful teachings in Islam. Find out what the historical origins of their faith are. I don't think that anyone would argue with the claims that Rabbi Yehuda Levi has made with the origins of Islam. By their own texts, the claim is that Muhammad had this revelation in a cave with the angel Jabril, who came and told him that all of the text of the Quran. Part of the plausibility of the divine nature of the Quran, they argue, is that Muhammad was illiterate. And so how could an illiterate farmer, or whatever he was, go into a cave and then come out with this amazing text?
I hear what you're saying, and I've heard the same thing about Mormons and Joseph Smith, and yet there are so many intelligent people in the world who believe all these things.
Yes.
And that's what gives me pause. We're not the only smart people in the world.
And guess what? There are a lot of really intelligent people who believe in Judaism but have never studied the arguments to demonstrate that Judaism is more plausible. Do you understand what I'm saying? There are a lot of people who have emunah pshuta. They have simple faith that this is our Mesorah. It provides us with a great sense of satisfaction emotionally, spiritually, socially, and therefore we embrace it. Have I ever bothered to do any comparative studies of religion? No, because I love this lifestyle. I love what it does for me. I love the way I feel when I go to church and so forth. You know Jews that are like that too? How many Jews do you know that have done a comparative study of religion? Very few. Very few. How many in this room have done a comparative study of religion? Very few. Right? I'm not advocating that you do it. If you don't feel that you need to, then a blessing on your head, mazel tov. Right? But if this is a gnawing issue for you, and you want to be able to really affirm to yourself, I'm doing this not just because my parents did it, but there's no greater legitimacy or veracity to it than Islam or Christianity, then you owe it to yourself to sort of read, open up this information for yourself, listen to a lecture from an imam, and read a book on Islam, and discover for yourself, or on Christianity. And I think the issue here is not whether they're inspiring. Religiously, they're inspiring, because they have the universal messages of these three faiths are pretty much all the same when it comes to trying to inspire us to become better people. There's no question that they have inspirational messages, but if you want to talk about the plausibility of the origins of their religion, then you have to come back to what the Khuzari is saying and see, does it match up?
So can I just ask one more question?
Yeah.
If you think that studying the other religions would lead an intelligent person to believe in the veracity of the Torah, I'm just wondering why all those other people who have studied believe in the veracity of their own religions.
But that's the point, is that while Rabbi Yehuda maintains that there is a greater plausibility to Torah, it's not ironclad. You have to see for yourself. You may come to the conclusion that there's a certain plausibility to the Quran, there's a certain plausibility to the New Testament, and a certain plausibility to the rejection of those two based on the Torah. Then you have a decision to make. What is most plausible for you? And if you come up and say, you know what, I believe that there was revelation, I believe in God, Judaism has its more salient points, but so do the other religions. The reason to go to the side of Torah at that point is to say, well, Shema b'ni Musar avicha ve'al titosh Torah asimecha. Then you have a Mesorah from your Babi and Zaidi. And it was good enough for them, then it's good enough for me. But if you come to the conclusion that the Torah is on weaker standing than the other two faiths, then you got to sit down and think about it really seriously. I don't think you'll ever come to that point. I think you'll come to the point that where you say to yourself, forget about the message itself, about what the teaching actually is, but let's just simply talk about the origin and the way that the claim is, how the religion was revealed, and whether it's of divine origin or not. I think you'll find that the claims of the Torah are the most plausible as far as a divine message. And that's really what what this is all about, this particular point. Yeah.
I think I just want to add, I think the reason why those other religions are so successful is because their basic principles are based on Judaism, mm-hmm. and they take Judaism, they strip off all the hard work, like all the mitzvahs, that's why it heals the masses, and that's why, you know, they take the basic way, which is what we're supposed to do, spread the shadow of the idea of God. And
yes, yes, yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. A lot of truth, yes.
You were saying that everybody has a place in the world to come, Christians, Islam. Well, if you're Jewish and you're not a religious Jew, do you have a place in the world to come?
Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek l'olam haba. That's what the Mishnah says. All Israel have a share in the world to come. But then the Mishnah says the following Jews do not have a share in the world to come. So it seems almost to contradict itself, meaning that there is a way for you to lose your spot. You know,
how do you lose your spot?
Well, it's a more lengthy discussion, but sort of you have to, if you reject sort of the basic doctrines of Judaism, then you lose your spot. What are the basic doctrines of Judaism? Maimonides has 13. Others have a different numbering system. And I don't want to get put into Cherem. I'm already going to get put into what I just, because of what I just said, so I'm going to hold it at that point. Right? Because someone's going to go on kosher tube and say, oh, see, Karapkins and Apikaris. Okay, go ahead.
I don't understand why the ex-pope of Mr. Ratzinger, who was born Jewish, raised Jewish, obviously studied theology, and became a Christian pope.
Human beings are very complicated.
There's not that many people that actually, like Jews, that convert to Christianity. But right. I know a lot of Christians that convert to Judaism.
Yes, yes.
But I can't understand why an intelligent man like that, who obviously studied a lot of theology in his day, and then converted to Christianity, and yet he has the chutzpah to say that the best food in the world is the Jewish food.
Well, okay, that's sort of a non sequitur, but you have to realize human beings are complicated creatures, and what motivates us many times is very, very difficult to untangle. The intellect from the emotion. And it's very, very hard to say that, very hard for any person to make a purely intellectual decision in their life. You have to also realize that he converted to Christianity, to Catholicism, I believe, shortly after the Shoah. He was a young man, or a young adult, a young teenager.
German.
How old was he?
No, where was he from? Was he from Germany? Yeah, he was German.
No, the French. They're talking about the French
no,
cardinal.
No, that's the new guy. We're talking about Mr. Ratzinger that retired.
But he's not Jewish.
Yes, he is. He was born Jewish. Absolutely.
I think you're confusing two
no,
things.
No, he was born Jewish.
Okay.
Not the new guy from
South America.
No, not him.
No, no, Ratzinger. The former pope was not Jewish. You're
yes,
thinking about the runner-up, the French cardinal.
Yeah.
The French cardinal.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
Mr. Ratzinger was Jewish.
No,
yes.
Okay.
He was born Jewish.
Anyway, okay. Whether he was born Jewish or not is okay. We can debate later. But the issue is, what causes people to convert to Christianity or to convert out of the faith? Of course, there are plenty of Jews. I had a disputation when I was a young rabbi with a fellow who was a Jews for Jesus, and he found his faith on the subway. You have to realize that the era that we live in is an era of complete secularism and atheism, which is prevailing today. In the 60s, it was, for a lot of Jews, there was a tremendous amount of pressure. Really, from post-Holocaust, there was a tremendous amount of pressure on the Jewish people. As a little boy, I don't remember them.
Okay.
It wasn't until 1967 that Jewish pride resurged within the Jewish people. And there was a feeling of, yeah, it's cool to be Jewish.
I was 16 then, yeah, in 67, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I was 3. So I thought it was pretty cool to be a Jew back then, too.
Okay.
But yeah.
No, sorry, I was going to go back to the verse.
Please, yeah.
Okay, so he's not saying that it's not possible for God to send a Navi that would inspire or change the entire world. He's just saying that, not just, but he's saying that he hasn't sent someone like this, who
right,
the other
right.
religions claim.
Right, and since we've never seen something like that.
But it is theoretically possible.
It's theoretically possible, and the follow-up question in paragraph 102, which is going to be on page 124, is, well, then why didn't he? Why didn't God change the whole world with the Torah? Why did he present it only to one nation? Here, we're just getting to the plausibility of the messenger of Moshe and the plausibility of the fact that he was presenting God's Torah to the people. Why he only presented it to the people, we're going to get to the next section. The next thing that he had pointed out was, again, the polemic against Islam specifically, which was, look at the fact that the Bible is in Hebrew. And if you want to provide a universal message to the entire world, then how can it be that God would limit it into one language? And this is clearly a polemic against the Quran, where Muslims say that you must study it in the original Arabic to understand it properly. You won't appreciate the divine nature of the Quran if you study it in a translated text. And that's why Muslims would say, well, the reason why you don't appreciate the Quran as being a divine document is because you don't know Arabic. Well, that, of course, explains everything. That's an easy dismissal, because then I can't debate you any longer, right? But Rabbi Yehuda Levi is taking that very argument and turning it upside down. And he's basically saying, well, the very fact that it was provided in Arabic proves that it's not meant for the whole world. Because then why would God create mankind in multiple languages and not provide his divine document in multiple languages to be able to get the message to the people that he needs to get the message to?
But that sort of, sorry, that's just a reflection of his time, because now it's, you know, it could be available for everybody.
Yeah, with Google Translate.
Right.
You know? Sure.
So that's a reflection of the time.
That's a reflection of the time. But the fact is that the Torah and the Quran and the New Testament are not being given in the year 2013. They're given millennia before we have the technology to create automatic translations.